happening in this area. And I was really happy that he just went through all of the things that Microsoft is doing in Boston, you know, and these and the lightning round. I mean, this is happening in Boston. If you just were reading the press, you would think everything was happening in Silicon Valley. There's a lot happening here, and that's we want to take in. My computer's not coming up. We want to take that in. Can you do that for me?
Yes,
you're number two.
Yeah, but this isn't coming up.
Right. Oh, that part doesn't.
Record.
Now we got to get you. Did you get laptop number two? Did you do this?
I'd done that and I tested it and it worked.
We have it.
There we go.
It's not in audio. You can
support. Just.
No, but it's still showing the other laptop.
All right. Well.
There we go.
But it's mine. It's my laptop.
Oh, you're number one, right?
I'm number one. All right.
There we go. You're there. No, Windows is shutting down.
This is my. We tested this. You know.
Yeah, I know you can't. You can't let it go off.
Would you just?
I'll sit there and play
you
with
just
it.
Just play with that one. Yeah. So let me introduce these folks, and then we'll get going. And
start
if we don't,
it back up again.
If we don't have our slides,
turning it back on.
That's okay.
Just went
too.
To sleep.
So the first time we did this SIG, the lawyers were the entertainment. And if you want to know why we're first, is we're supposed to get you going. And if you can believe that the lawyers are going to be, you know, not so much entertainment, but this is supposed to be a very interactive discussion. We can go through all of our slides. I have lots of them. We have different things we can talk about. But what we would really like to do is to get into a conversation about, you know, about things that are happening. And let me tell you who I have with us today and why this is a representation of things that are going on in Boston. So Scott Peterson was supposed to be here and sends his regrets. He is from Hewlett-Packard, and he was on Committee B of the GPL3 committees. Ira was the chair of Committee A of the GPL3 committees. Ira has been at Goodwin Procter. He had been at Testa Hurwitz before that, has been working in open source for many years, and he just became the general counsel of Topcoder, which is another wonderful and exciting thing that's happening in and around Boston. You want to talk a little bit, just for a minute, about what's happening with Topcoder?
Okay. Yeah, no, it's a... Hi, thanks. Yeah, no, so Topcoder is a community-based software development company that is, you know, sort of has a unique model. It's not open source, but it's a community model for custom software development. And so.
And sitting next to him is David Rickerby. David was at Testa with me, and he is at Choate Hall and Stewart with me, and he was on the Hacker Committee, Committee D. So here we have, I think we may have a couple of other people who were on committees. But in this whole process, this GPL3 process, sometimes you would have thought that everybody that participated in the GPL3 process was in Silicon Valley. There was actually a lot of participation because the Free Software Foundation actually, you know, it resides here in Boston. So we all participated on the committees in the process. And, oh, thank you so much.
Is that what you wanted?
Yeah, so there's a problem with who where it loses one of the colors. What's this sort of
that's okay. Oh, there it is.
You have to get it destroyed. I remember that from last time.
I had experts.
Still loose.
I have to tell you a story, though, while they're going on, because it's such a funny story. So I was in an open source think tank out in California a couple of weeks ago. And Justin was there. A couple of other people were there. And there must have been, I'd say 120 people, and the internet went down. It went down in this very irritating way. You would get signed on, which meant you had to go through the hotel thing where you put the credit card in, and they'd say you didn't fill it out right, and it would make you go back and do it all over again. And then it would be on for approximately 12 minutes, and whatever you were doing, it would die and you would lose it. And they had, you know, you had 120 people at an open source conference with their laptops losing their stuff. So people were very irritated. There was a fellow who came in to their business center who was working on the server, and he came up to explain to us what was happening. And it was, you know, he was just picture this. This kid's about maybe 19, and he's standing up in front of all these people telling people about what was happening. And he said, "It's a problem with Internet Explorer." And he was trying to explain how if you could just turn something off, And the fellow who was actually talking to him listened to him very patiently, and I think he deserves a Nobel Peace Prize, because he said, I'm from Microsoft. I worked on Internet Explorer. I know how to turn that off, and I'll guarantee you that that's not the problem. And the 19-year-old's face just like slid off, you know? I mean, it just like collapsed. But I thought the fellow just deserved a prize for keeping himself so calm in this process. And they never did get the server to work. So David and I have been working together on open source issues for a long time. David, you want to talk a little bit about how Committee D did their hosted their discussions? Just because I think that that's entertaining.
Yeah, I don't know if it's entertaining. I'll talk a little bit about it. And first, I want to say I'm sorry for the ultra Choate presence on the panel, but I got lucky enough after begging and pleading to hire Karen back at Choate out of Black Duck. So I'm pleased about that as well. The Committee D was an interesting proposition for me. I learned a lot on Committee D. I've enjoyed it greatly. For those of you who want to find out what happened on Committee D, we did all of our meetings on IRC. They were all done on chat. They were all logged, and all the logs were posted publicly. So everything that was said on Committee D is public. It was very interesting for me as someone who probably is a hacker at heart, but who represents a lot of commercial software clients, because we would have these long discussions just going on about the rights and freedoms and how it was just immoral to profit from certain things. And then at the end of these long discussions, where I'd sat rather quietly and listened, the line would come up, so everybody agrees, right? And I would think to myself, well, I can be recorded in posterity as agreeing, or I can say no and start the biggest flame war of the day. So I unanimously agreed every time. But it was a fabulous experience, and it is very interesting. I mean, for people, for the real open source geeks, to if you want to sort of dig in and see the debate that went on about the various terms in Committee D, they're all there and available.
Committee D is what?
It's the hackers committee. It's the writers of the various software projects.
And to introduce myself last, so I away from there. I originally was at IBM, and then I was on the West Coast at a firm, and then I was at Testa Hurwitz, and I so much enjoyed working with David there that I came back. But I had a wonderful time at Black Duck, and I still work with Black Duck regularly. You could ask me about what they do. And I'm now working at Choate, and I'm also the Director of Intellectual Property Strategy for the Linux Foundation. So I'm having a ball. So what's that? Okay. So, and my computer apparently went off again because I can't do the page down. There we go. So what I wanted to do very quickly.
You can just stand right there.
Can I stand right here?
And there's a mic right here.
And there's a mic right here. And if I can do the page down, I can see over here. Okay. So what we wanted to do really quickly, because I didn't want people to think that the only thing that happened in this last year was GPL3, was that we would look at some of the things. This is really about 18 months, but there's a lot of things that that happened in the last, and I'm going to go quickly because we only have a few minutes, but there are a lot of things that have happened in the open source world in the past year. And there are a few that I just wanted to, this one was interesting. This is at the Open Source Summit, and there was, excuse me?
Say something, remember recording.
Oh, we were recording it. So this is the CIO panel at the Open Source Think Tank. And we'd had a think tank a few years before, and you know, when we brought up the users, and it was a very different discussion. They were talking about, you know, their concerns about various things. And this year, as they brought up, you know, like three different panels of CIOs, they said basically we don't care. They said it over and over again. We're looking for the throat to choke. Don't come in and tell us that we ought to be happy that this is open source. That's not meaningful to us. It's functionality. It's support. It's tell us the story of why we ought to be believers. Open source is just a minor part of the story. But it was a very interesting discussion. Give me a reason to believe. There was a lot of pressure for interoperability, and I think that's the real story in the last year is commercialization and the pressure of the commercial marketplace coming to bear and having customers be heard. There was an observation made, and I thought this was an interesting one, about how open source adoption is driven in different parts of the world. And in the U.S., it's driven by commercial enterprise, which I think is interesting. In Europe, it's really by the OS community, and in Asia, by the governments. And that's a high-level gloss, but I think they're interesting concepts there. And I think it's interesting that in the United States, it actually is the commercial marketplace that is driving adoption. The other thing I thought was very interesting this year that some of you may not have heard of is that there was a process where a company called Blackboard had acquired what most people assumed, I don't know whether with a lot of analysis or not, but assumed was a very, very broad patent. And it was a patent that covered most of the products in their space, which related to universities launching of distance learning. And the universities got together and took a position because the universities were their customers. And said, you know, we're really not happy that that you're beginning to make people feel uncomfortable about this patent and what effect that patent will have on this project that we've hosted, which is called the Sakai Project, which was an open source project to do some of the same things. And Blackboard listened to their customers and gave a pledge that they would not assert the patent against the open source community. And I think that whole interplay with customers is going to be a part of the story coming up about how that works. And then what we wanted to do was to talk for a few minutes about the GPL3 because it is a very interesting thing. And one of the most interesting things about it, which we can all talk about on our committees, is, you know, GPL1 happened with three people in a room. GPL2 happened, nobody ever, you know, thought about it. GPL3 happened and every major player in the computer industry was involved in some way. And, you know, that says a lot about what has happened, that it was really a negotiation with the commercial entities as to, you know, how this license came out. And it was a very interesting process. One of the things that was interesting about it is that we all hated GPL2 until we started looking at GPL3, and then we thought GPL2 was great. I mean, you know, it just became wonderful. So that was funny. But it was also that there was an education process on the committees. We all were on different committees. All of us learned a lot. We learned a lot about the interpretation of the GPL, but we learned even more about how companies were relying on it and how, you know, the lore was developing. It drives everybody crazy, but when you talk about open source licenses, there are really three things you have to understand. You have to understand the law, which those people who get up and say, I'm not a lawyer, but let me tell you what this means, you know, sort of object to. And you have to understand the lore, the L-O-R-E, because this is a living document. It's a social contract. It's, you know, it changes over time. It doesn't take great leaps forward, but it just begins to change, and then people become comfortable with a consensus, and it moves. And so if you go back and do look at the original documentation and say, well, you know, I'm going to interpret the words that were written 15 years ago, you really can't get there in terms of how it's interpreted now. And then the last thing you have to understand is the lore, the L-U-R-E. So it's the law, the lore, and the lore. And to understand really how this is driving people in the commercial marketplace. But we all enjoyed that. So what we thought we would go through is there were really five original goals, and each of us participated in different ways in these discussions. But I thought we would just talk about the original goal and then where we came. And anyone who wants to participate or has questions, please feel free to do so. So the first of the five sections, license compatibility and the Affero provision. You want to talk about that one? Or no, it was you were going to talk about that one.
Karen, there are a couple people here who don't know what GPL is.
Which I was kind of,
if you could give a high feedback.
Or David, do you want to, because I've talked enough, yeah. You talk at a high level about what GPL is.
Okay. So, basically, to really simplify this, in open source, I mean, in my mind, open source means that the source code is available, it's open. It really initially comes down to, it divides down into two schools. And one school is, I think of as the academic licenses, Apache and BSD, where the source code is available for everybody to use, and all it says is, give me credit and don't sue me, right? Then there's another school, which is free software, and that's free as in free speech, not as in free beer. And the GPL is the primary license, is the standard bearer in the free software arena, and what it contains is and I know the open source community doesn't like the term, but it's the most descriptive term is a viral provision, right? Or an enforced sharing provision was
reciprocal.
Thank you. A reciprocal provision, which requires that if you use the source code, actually if you redistribute the source code that you have taken or a derivative work of it, that you also then make the source code of your derivative work available. And I guess that's it. And so the GPL is the standard bearer. It is the basic license under which Linux is released. And so it has become the basic license under which many, many projects are released. It is, I'll say one last thing, which was the primary question, which did not get resolved by GPL3, but I think we all learned a lot about, was what it meant. What was a derivative work? We all spent a lot of time arguing about what that meant, and I think there was some deliberate ambiguity in GPL2, and that will continue into GPL3, although we've solved a lot of the problems around the edges.
And I just always make the comment that this is about the license. You know, open source is really about the collaborative development model that the licenses it make possible in some way or another. So GPL is a license.
So Ira, you want to talk about compatibility?
Yeah, I mean, it might be worth, we mentioned the committees, it might be worth just talking about, for. I know you have some slides on that, but yeah.
I have lots of slides.
On the process, that. Yeah. So we talk about the committees. What the Free Software Foundation did in trying to basically update its new license was to organize groups of constituencies, as they saw them, to give them sort of more organized feedback on this license. So they were clear that the license ultimately was going to be decided by them. It wasn't a license that was put out to vote, but that they were looking for feedback from everywhere that they could get it. And in order to help foster that, they organized these groups of committees to give them more formal feedback on the drafts. And so they had a number of drafts of the license, and each time there was a draft, these different committees would get together and in different ways, you know, whether it was on IRC or I was on Committee A, which was a collection of organized open source projects, basically. So projects that were either under the GPL, the primary, this license that was being drafted, or under other licenses. And so other communities like Eclipse and Apache. And so our group would get together. We had an email list going, and we had weekly or biweekly phone calls where we get together and just talk about the different issues on the license with representatives from Free Software Foundation. So, like I said, the committee I was on, Committee A, was other open source communities. And so one of the big things that our committee was very concerned about was the compatibility of other licenses with the GPL. And the GPL is always, the previous version of the GPL, version 2, has been compatible with some other licenses. That is a subset of the academic licenses that David was referring to, in a interesting way, right? Compatibility with respect to the GPL means that you can take that other code and incorporate it into the GPL code and then relicense the whole thing under the GPL. So it's compatible in the sense that that code can be assimilated into the GPL code, right? And so the question, the version 2 of the GPL had language in it that prevented additional restrictions from being placed on the code other than what's in the GPL. So you couldn't say, yeah, I'm licensed under the GPL and I'm putting some other restrictions on your use on it. That was not allowed under the GPL. And so what an effort was made in this round of the drafting to say, you know, we'd really like to get more open source code that's currently under other licenses under this possibility of being compatible. And so originally, I think they were trying to pull in even more licenses, but I think it became pretty clear in the drafting that it was only going to be the academic licenses, and then it was, as David has referred to them, and then it's which, you know, licenses. And I think the big step forward that they reached was to allow the Apache code, you know, they sort of reached agreement in working with the Apache Foundation to bring the Apache code in as compatible under the GPL. And so that's going to mean that people can take code from the, you know, many Apache Foundation projects as well as other code that's under an Apache license and bring it in to GPL code. And all of a sudden, there's a much larger code base that can be integrated. So that's a great thing. One thing that was very interesting about this process was they thought that they had achieved Apache compatibility, and then some people started reading one line in the Apache license a different way, and it had to do with what indemnifications a contributor was going to be entitled to. And so then there involved a whole discussion between the Free Software Foundation and the Apache Foundation about what that line meant and whether it was going to be problematic. And in this version, they've concluded, and they say, and Free Software Foundation says in the rationale documents that they put out, we now understand what the Apache Foundation meant by this, and we read it that way too. And so now we say the Apache license is compatible. And so that was, I think, a great outcome, you know, for the license.
And that, you know, broadening the base of components that can be reused is a great, you know, is a great thing. You guys are so quiet. Is there? Yes. Go ahead.
Question. So is the result then that the Apache plus GPL code is licensed under the Apache license?
So the Apache plus GPL is, I am repeating it, right? So the question is, the Apache plus GPL code, is it licensed under the Apache license, right? And the answer is no. It gets assimilated because of the terms of the GPL as it was written before and as it's written now, that when you have code that's under the GPL, that derivative, and though that's not the word that's used anymore, has to be licensed under the GPL. So those, the copyleft licenses, all require that. Right, so if you take code that doesn't have copyleft, you can pull it in under and relicense it essentially under this copyleft license, and now the whole thing is now under GPL. Without having to go back to the original author and get permissions, and you know, to the extent that those two things aren't separate enough not to be derivative works and so on. But that's the yeah. Yeah.
That means that you have to be careful. Wait, hold on. Wait.
Here we go.
Yes.
So does that mean you need to be careful as to where you got your Apache component? If it came bundled as part of a GPL license distribution, then that component is now GPL licensed, not Apache licensed.
Thank you, Dan. Yeah. So right. So. No, so that's a great question, right? So if you have code that's under one license and then it gets pulled in and relicensed under the GPL, you know, what can you do with that piece that originally was under the Apache license, right? And so we actually spent a fair amount of time talking about that in our committee, right? And so, but I think the easy answer to that, right, is that if the Apache code, say you have Apache code, you pull it into GPL, right? If the Apache code hasn't changed, you can go back to the source of the Apache code and get it under the Apache license, and it remains under the Apache license. The fact that this whole thing has been distributed under GPL doesn't change that, right? It doesn't change what's going on over here. So this gets licensed under Apache. That particular thing has the Apache terms that apply to it and the GPL terms that apply to it, to the extent that it's, you know, sort of an integrated work that's now under the GPL. But you could still go and get that. So it gets more complicated, right? If this thing has started to change and someone has taken it under the GPL and they've made changes, the thing that's complicated is under the combined thing, not under the original, right? No one can ever change the license that the original is under. Right? Does that, that's the question you're asking, right?
Yeah, and I do have, I guess, one follow-up question, but it's the bundle.
Yeah, well, you want to ask about bundling? Because there's the question of bundling in terms of when does it become that you need to put the two together, and when do they stay apart? Is that...
Well, actually, I just had a question about if you actually were to change the part of the Apache part that was part of this bundle and you distributed that, then you didn't change Apache code, you changed the actual GPL licensed distribution, and you'd have to redistribute that.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to think about it. Yeah, I mean, this really, but the other question you asked, right, so now you are, it does increase the amount of scrutiny that you need to give the code because, you know, you have some stuff that's going to have Apache notices on it, but it's really part of this GPL work, so that's going to make that a little bit more complicated. So I think the simple answer is that you, you know, just go back and get it from where you got it because that'll be easy. But, you know, if this is what you've got, then you're going to have to think about it a little harder, is that, you know, ultimately.
That's okay. That's okay. Here you go.
A question that I have, we talk about the derivative works part, but it seems to me that GPL is really a distribution license. And until we start distributing the code, we're really not too concerned about things. And I'm curious, does GPL 3 talk any further about what distribution is? I mean, traditionally, distribution was handing a CD. Today, with services delivered by the Internet, that's not happening.
I want to answer the part of that because part of that is the is an absolute perfect segue into sort of one of the second big issues, which was one of the big issues on Committee D, which was the Afero clause. And for those of you who are not familiar with it, a Afero license is an offshoot of the GPL, where they basically tackle one of the major loopholes in the GPL, which is, as you correctly stated, the GPL isn't triggered until you distribute the software. So you get the software and you can use it all you want internally. With the growth of software as a service, what a number of companies began doing was using GPL software on a hosted basis to provide a service. And so that it was there, it was being used by thousands and thousands of people, but the source code wasn't available because it was, you know, officially never distributed to them. They were just accessing the functionality of the software. Afero basically plugs that hole by saying that I won't give you the exact legal language, but for that type of use, you are required to make the source code available as well. We had an enormous debate on Committee D, very fascinating, very interesting debate on Committee D about how you could require someone to make the code available in a situation like that, and whether that meant that, you know, a person who was logged into your server, you'd be required to mail them a CD of the source code, and, you know, sort of the logistical issues of that. And I think that's ultimately, there were some people on Committee D that very strongly wanted Afero included as a standard clause in GPL3. It is not, you know, it went back to the Free Software Foundation. The pluses and minuses of that were debated. But the Free Software Foundation immediately, a week after releasing this last best draft of GPL3, released a new version of the Afero license, which amusingly is Afero 3. There was an Afero number 1, and then they went straight to 3 just to keep the numbers the same, so there is no Afero 2. But released a new draft of the Afero license, and they sort of released it with a, you know, on the charts with a bullet. They said, and we think people should really look closely at the Afero license. It may be more appropriate. Maybe it should be more broadly adopted. So I think we may see that happening more.
So let's we've just got a few minutes left, and I'd love to, oh, we got a question from the audience.
Yeah, it's a good question going in a different direction. The scenario of like a MySQL, where they have a open source version, and then they have a proprietary version. How does that handle it from a licensing point of view? I mean, why isn't that considered to be a derivative work under GPL3?
That goes back to just basic copyright law, and there's not anything that Free Software Foundation can do about that, because what MySQL does is they have you assign, if you want to be in their project, it's not, for most open source projects, if I contribute to it, I'm licensing to the project under the GPL. MySQL has you assign ownership of your code over to them. They then own the code and can choose what license it goes under. So they can choose to offer one version under a commercial license and another version under the GPL. And as the owner, and it's actually, it's in the interest of the community to encourage that model to the extent that it gets more code released on an open basis. But you can't, you can't go back up and grab the owner's rights, at least not if you want owners to contribute.
Hey, you were going to, oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Did you want to talk about DRS? I was just going to say, David.
Nope.
Yeah. Nope. You're going to talk about DRM.
Although Committee D had a lot of fun with DRM too, so I'll let you start.
Another part of the license that our Committee A spent a lot of time thinking about, and is even still, you know, even as to last night, was going back and forth about were the anti-DRM provisions, which are provisions in the license that in different iterations, essentially required someone who's distributing software under the license to provide the information that's needed to load the software into some kind of device. So, in other words, you couldn't distribute GPL software in a way where the software, where you could give someone the source code, but you don't give them the essential information that they need to load that software into some kind of hardware, right? So using some sort of hardware protection.
Example?
TiVo is the big example. Thank you. So TiVo is the example that was discussed a lot in terms of that they are, I guess were said to be using GPL code, but had some kind of hook where the software had to be signed with some kind of key before changes to the software could be loaded into the TiVo. And so they went, there was a lot of back and forth on that, on thinking about to what extent the license was actually going to prevent people from using the code in a DRM scenario. And this is one of the main points, from what I understand, that the Linux kernel team has objected to, is that they, because of their interest in getting the Linux kernel, out and everywhere, they don't want hardware manufacturers to be afraid of using Linux for fear that they would somehow run afoul of the DRM provision. And I say somehow run afoul. Sometimes it's quite clear how they would run afoul of it, but sometimes it's not that clear. And the compromise, at least as it stands now, right, that was reached, is that sort of anti-DRM provision. There's some other anti-DRM provisions, but this particular one would only apply to consumer devices. So they've tried to narrow out the scope of devices so that it's really about consumers getting GPL software in some sort of device and being able to hack around with it, allowing certain kinds of uses, for example, medical devices or places where the safety might be involved or where companies are involved and where they might agree, we don't really need to see that. We'd rather have the security that's involved. But, the problem with the word consumer devices, of course, is that it could be read very broadly, right? And it's written in a way in the current draft where it is very broad. And so there's, I think it would really, it's only certain very specialized devices where you'd end up thinking, well, that really isn't a consumer device, so we're okay there. And DRM would be okay. So I think, it's a big compromise from Free Software Foundation to even restrict to consumer devices, but that's where that at least currently stands in this last call draft.
And I on that, and then let Karen talk patents real fast. But on that, I think that may actually be a Committee D solution, because the strongest voice on Committee D were the people who were saying, the anti-DRM makes sense. Everybody on Committee D is very in favor of anti-DRM, but except for you want to be able to lock the device in your data center. We understand you want to be secure in your data center. You don't want to be hacked. And so I think that's where sort of when the hackers came out and said, yes, it's fine to have DRM in your data center or in a medical device, that's when you sort of saw that exception get built in. I think that's where it came from. So, yay, one for Committee D.
Good job.
And that's right. And the other concern is that it changes. I mean, a Hummer was not a commercial device or a commercial product, but it is now. And so, you know, the idea is that things change over time. And, you know, you didn't used to have a router in a home, but you do now. So, you know, the change. And the other thing that's important about DRM is just to realize it doesn't apply, those rules don't apply if the hardware manufacturer can't change the code either. Because it doesn't mean that you can't have an embedded application. You can have an embedded application. And our time is about up. We could talk for patents about all morning, and I figured if we did, we would put you to sleep. The patent license in GPL2 was implied. It wasn't stated. There is an express patent license in GPL3. There's a lot of very, very complex patent provisions put into GPL3 that probably were the biggest subject of discussion, and all of us could talk about them, but we're going to talk about them offline. Let's take one more question from the audience. You want to go ahead?
You're all set.
Okay. Just a quick question about the anti-TiVoization provision. Of course, that seems a little hostile to TiVo. And I was just wondering, were there any discussions with TiVo? Is there any possibility of finding a common ground, or is it just pretty much an impasse?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what negotiations were held with TiVo or not, and I guess it's their misfortune that they've sort of been held out as the anti-TiVo. But it, you know, even though it it sort of seems like it's directed at TiVo, I think it's really the broader issue, right? I mean, even newer versions of Windows have some ways where software can be locked down, and I think, you know, there's at least discussion that that could be the intent going forward, right? And there's hardware facilities in some of the processors to try and have a possibility of locking down software. So even though it's called anti-TiVoization, it's really, I think, directed towards the general concept of, you know, DRM on software, you know, sort of in the same way that you could have DRM on music and you can only listen to it on one player. You know, what if this this free software is restricted because of the hardware restrictions on the devices? You know, and what if that ultimately, I mean, some people on my committee had, you know, so this idea, well, what if that ultimately gets mandated, that you have to have hardware that has this sort of thing in order to run in certain situations? And then that could ultimately restrict users' freedom to get the software and make the changes and do what they want, right? And so that's the concern.
I think it's very important when you're talking about that issue to look at content control, because especially in the hackers forum, it was that if I'm writing software to play MP3s, I don't want somebody else to take my code, then lock it down so that it only plays, you know, on an iPod or on a this or a that. The point is, I'm writing, you know, software to, especially they were more concerned about video, to relay video across the internet, and I don't want someone else to make financial gains off of that and yet not make that content free.
So, and we'll close with just saying, you know, the story of the year is that we're all here. And that, you know, you look at the people here that were being hosted so graciously by Microsoft, and again, thank you for making this possible. It was very, very gracious of you to invite us in. But that these concepts of open development platforms and sharing, and I've been saying for years, this is really an acknowledgement of the fact that we all live in a world in which we are completely and totally dependent on each other. None of us stand alone. And, you know, shared development is not correct for everything, but there are some things that we need to learn how to do together across boundaries, you know, across boundaries between companies, across boundaries between countries, and that this, you know, I see as really the beginning of a process of learning how to deal with the fact that we are completely and totally interdependent and dependent on one another. And how do we work that out? How do we work those differences out? And so I thank you for all for being here today. We're here, so if you have any questions, any discussions you want to have, we're open for it, and we thank you very much for your attention.